listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Saturday, November 10th, marks the 120th anniversary of the only documented coup d'etat in the United States. This event ousted elected representatives from office in Wilmington, North Carolina. It terrorized families, causing them to run for their lives and hide along the banks of the Cape Fear River over frigid November days and nights. And the massacre left an unknown number of people dead. That's a critical element of our examination, the unknown, possibly unknowable death toll. There are gaps in the evidence, basic facts we haven't been able to flesh out. Historians and scholars have struggled to reconstruct the phenomena leading up to the coup. Most recently, two local writers created Third Person Project, born out of another project with local students. Those two writers are with us today. John Jeremiah Sullivan might be best known for his collection of essays entitled Pulphead. He is also the author of Blood Horses and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's a current Guggenheim Fellow. He writes for GQ, Harper's Magazine, and Oxford American. His research on 1898 will be published in the New York Times Magazine in an upcoming issue. John Jeremiah Sullivan, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
His collaborator, Joel Finzel, has written a memoir about coming of age behind bars, cocktails and conversations from the astral plane. Joel's articles and recipes have appeared in Cosmopolitan, Devour, the Oxford American, Salt, Playboy.com, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He has a biography coming out soon about Franz Klein, and he joins us now. Joel Finzel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
We've spent so much time talking about what we don't know about the 1898 coup d'etat. What do you know now, because of your research, your recent research, that you think other people probably don't know, John Jeremiah Sullivan?
Oh, we're still left with a lot of questions. I don't want to claim to have any kind of final grasp on it. It's such a dark event. It has so many layers to it. And was so carefully concealed that you're dealing with a pretty slippery subject, no matter how much research you accumulate. But there had been some really good work done on this when we started out. The state report that Larrey Umfleet oversaw, I think, is a pretty extraordinary document. And a new essay collection out called Democracy Betrayed that I think is probably one of the best things that's been done in 1898. So we were definitely building on some solid work, but we were able to find some crevices that hadn't been looked into yet.
There's been debate over, for instance, whether a white person or a person of color fired the first shot, murdered the first person, and what do we know about that now?
Yeah, that's true. The white supremacists like to claim that the blacks had fired first, and so that the massacre had been set off as a kind of, in self-defense. But Joel found something really interesting. Would you talk about the letter you found at the National Archives?
Sure. It's an anonymous letter, and it was written by a woman who claims that someone was killed that wasn't reported in the newspapers in front of Love and Charity Hall on 7th Street, where the Daily Record was being housed at the time, because they didn't get out of the way fast enough. They were standing in front of the door. So
paint this picture for us. So there's a mob now. This is November 10th.
And the accounts sometimes say 200, sometimes say 1,000, sometimes say 600. The numbers are all over the place. But apparently they marched 4 abreast from 5th and Market Street up to 7th and made a right. And then they made it to Love and Charity Hall and left different people at different corners, almost like a military action to protect the group.
And they were heading for the Daily Record, which was the newspaper owned and published by Alexander Manley.
The only black-owned daily at the time.
In the South.
But this wasn't their first stop, the Daily Record. John Jeremiah Sullivan, the night before the coup d'etat, a group, possibly a small mob, a community, went to Judge Robert Bunting's house. What was that about? Who was Judge Bunting?
Yeah, this to me is probably the most interesting piece of the story, the one that puts out tendrils into almost every other part of it, and it has been overlooked a little bit in my view in the telling of how 1898 happened, not just how it unfolded over a few days of the massacre and coup, but how it unfolded nationally over the next couple of years. And there's one couple at the center of that, Mr. and Mrs. Bunting, who occupied a place in the town's imagination. Robert Bunting was the son of one of the old Wilmington families. The Buntings had been here since the 1730s. His father had been the sheriff right after the Civil War. And he himself was a well-known figure in the community, a justice of the peace, active in Republican politics. And his courtroom was known as a place where blacks could find something closer to equal justice, which in the eyes of the white supremacists meant favoritism, and that they themselves were being overlooked. So he was a figure of some controversy already, just for that. And you can see articles in the days leading up to the massacre saying, "Oh, if you want to see what the Republicans are getting away with at the expense of decent white folks, stop by Judge Bunting's courtroom." So that they had him singled out. But the thing that really drove him crazy is that he lived openly with an African American woman whom he called his wife and who was known to be his wife. He identified her as a cook for the purposes of the city directory. She was a kind of live-in servant, but everybody knew what was going on. And in fact, in November of 1898, she was 5 months pregnant with their child, so probably starting to show. So you had that, you had his court, you had the marriage, you had the fact that he was a U.S. commissioner, so he is a living representative of federal authority in the city, of Yankee authority. And you end up with a situation where a lot of people had what they thought of as good reasons to hate him. So yeah, that's the first place the mob goes, really. You know, when you hear the story downtown on the tour, they'll always say that they went first to the Daily Record building to burn it. And there is truth to that. That was kind of the first official stop. But before they'd done that, they went to the Bunting's house. And Bunting and his wife had received some kind of warning, so they'd already fled the premises. The mob went inside and ransacked the place. They tore up all the furniture and threw things out into the yard. And the most important thing they did was that they grabbed off the wall two portraits, one of Bunting and one of his wife, and they went out into the street, into Market Street, and walked down. His house was between 13th and 14th. They walked down about six blocks to the corner of 7th and Market, and they hung these portraits from the limb of a giant oak tree that was growing there at the corner, kind of the signal tree of the town. And under his portrait, there was a piece of canvas that read, "Judge Bunting, white." And then under her portrait, under Minnie's portrait, it said, "Mrs. Bunting, colored." And those portraits end up hanging there for the entirety of the massacre and coup, and for many days following. They're kind of the sign under which the whole thing unfolds, reminding every person who walks underneath them of the audacity that the Republicans had been guilty of in the days leading up to the massacre. And they hang there as a kind of goad. And there's even a piece of writing, in fact, one of the first documents published after the massacre that referred to it just weeks after it happened. The author says that, you know, points to the portraits as one of the inciting events, saying, you know, things wouldn't have gotten quite as nasty if they hadn't hung those portraits of Mr. and Mrs. Bunting there.
Alexander Manley, editor and owner of the Daily Record, published an editorial arguing that not all interracial relationships constituted rape. When did that fireball land in the middle of the public conversation, Joel Finsel?
I believe the original issue of that editorial was August 18th that year, And the interesting thing that we found in our research about that editorial is that it wasn't in response to a recent speech. It was in response to a speech that had been given a year earlier and that had recently been printed in the Morning Star, and that it was also reprinted almost every day for about 3 months leading up to the election as an inflammatory.
Alexander Manley's editorial was published daily leading up to the election.
Pieces of it were, the most inflammatory pieces were.
With certain words changed to make it even more insulting to white supremacists.
And what's an example of that?
There's a section in which Manley is saying you need to be more careful with your women, essentially, that if you weren't treating them so poorly, they wouldn't be looking to consort with men of another race. And there are just a couple of words that are changed to make it seem that he's really speaking directly against the virtue of the women themselves, whereas when you read the original, it's more clear that he's addressing it at the white population in general, the white rural population. It's a small thing. The editorial, even in its worst form, doesn't say anything that's shocking to us. But at the time, it was inflammatory, and it was talking about a subject that was just reliable for its power to inflame white anger. And if you read Rebecca Felton's speech, it's really vile. And
her speech, just to be clear, she's the wife of Congressman William Felton, and she gave a speech, the original speech, which is what inspired Alexander Manley to write that editorial. What did she say?
About lynching 1,000 men a week if necessary.
And why?
To protect the white virtue of the white women on the farms.
That they were saying that they were being raped, by the hundreds. And any sexual contact between a white woman and a black man at that time was painted as rape, no matter how consensual it had been. So by that standard, her statistics were probably right, although they were, completely warped. But, it touched off a domino effect. And when you play the whole thing out, you can see how sex really ran through what happened in 1898 at a very deep level, and one that we're still trying to reckon with. It's just an area where I think we in America in general are just still so squeamish that it can be hard to talk about what really happened. But you begin with this speech, arguing that black men are committing rape on white women all of the time. Then Manley responds saying, hey, that's not always rape. In fact, most of it's not rape. We're actually attracted to each other sometimes. And then the white supremacist press throughout the state and throughout the country to a certain extent is able to use that back and forth to whip things up with it and to distort what Manley had said until it seemed like a kind of defense almost of sexual assault and an attack on the virtue of white women. At the same time, there's something else interesting happening, which also has a strong sexual element, which is that from outside of the city, you have this campaign of emasculation, right? A lot of the white supremacist propaganda takes the form very explicitly of emasculation. You white men in Wilmington, you let these little black boys follow you down the street and catcall your women. You're not men. We know what to do with them out here in the counties, And it's really twisted, but also has a kind of it's very effective as propaganda, I think. The idea was to leave the white men here feeling that if they didn't do something, if they didn't act, if they didn't strike, that they had been unmanned.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the 120th anniversary of the only coup d'etat on American soil. That's coming up November 10th. This massacre took place in Wilmington, North Carolina. With us today to share some of the results of their research are two writers who founded Third Person Project, John Jeremiah Sullivan and Joel Finzel. Today's interviews, as a reminder, are pre-recorded. You also found, in going through the National Archives that there's a collection of letters asking for help from people in Wilmington, North Carolina? Joel Finzel, these letters, what kind of help were they asking for, and is there any evidence they ever got any help?
Well, the letters were scattered from various places in the South. There was something that happened similarly in South Carolina with the Tolbert family, and so you see letters coming. They were all collected together in the same box, places from Louisiana, Georgia. It was like, we don't know what else to do with these letters. We'll just put them all together in one place. Specifically, there the two from Wilmington that I can think of, they're written from anonymous folks, and they're basically just begging for help. They're asking the federal government to come in, and they're saying, you're a Republican, President McKinley. We have a Republican governor, Daniel Russell. We have Republican majorities in most of the Congresses, state and national. And if our own party can't protect us, who can? And if you can't protect us, what are the alternatives? Should we be sent somewhere else? Should we be given our own state? You know, we have to come up with something here to stop the slaughter from happening.
And there's no evidence that there was ever a response?
Well, there is an interesting line that John discovered in one of the newspapers describing the attorney general at the time.
Well, it describes his style, his managerial style as one of masterful inactivity. He was just really good at not doing anything.
But there was also another reason why, because for the federal government to bring troops in, there would have been another response coming out of Fort Caswell. So it could have escalated the violence in ways that we couldn't even imagine, I think.
Is there any evidence, is there any way to account for the property, like the Buntings house, for instance, that was either lost or stolen through these events?
It's one of the knottiest questions connected with 1898 and really hard to get concrete answers on, partly because many of the documents do seem to have been destroyed or made to discreetly disappear somehow. The deeds for a lot of those properties are pretty spotty. And there was a dissertation written at UNCW arguing that this was a kind of myth about 1898, that there had been a lot of property seizure and just theft of wealth, robbery of wealth. I think that it did happen, and that we can really only say it didn't happen by kind of defining property theft in an overly specific way. And the reason I say that is that immediately after the massacre, in the days following, you have stories that begin circulating in the white and black press about, blacks who are fleeing the city in fear for their lives and in desperate need of cash. Right, they need to get north, and things have happened so quickly. They maybe don't have enough money on them, so they're selling their houses for ridiculously cheap just to get some traveling money. There are scenes of whites taking advantage of that situation. So I think that kind of thing happened. We know that people were swindled out of their land by shady real estate practices, and plenty of it happens. As it had to happen, there's no way to avoid it. When you take a community of people who are becoming fairly well-to-do, which is one of the things the white supremacists hated about them, that they were rising up through the class structure, and they have a lot of property and goods, and then you just drive more than 1,000 of them out of town, you've kind of already achieved that in a way, because you've struck such a blow at the economic solidity of that community that I think the loss was very large, and the fact that it is hard to calculate doesn't make it any less awful.
You're listening to Coastline. John Jeremiah Sullivan, Joel Finzel, thank you both so much for sharing part of your work with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, historian and former city councilman Earl Sheridan joins us. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.